Thank you for listening to today's episode of JAT Chat, a podcast from the Journal of Athletic Training. My name is Chris Coons, and I'm the Associate Editor for Digital Applications at the Journal of Athletic Training. While JAT Chat is normally a live video event hosted on our Facebook and Twitter feeds, we thought it would be nice to mix it up a little bit this month and offer a podcast episode. On today's podcast, I will be interviewing Dr. Tim McGuine from the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. McGuine and colleagues recently published a paper in the Journal of Athletic Training titled "The Influence of Athletic Trainers on the Incidence and Management of Concussions in High School Athletes," and I thought this would be a great time to have him on to discuss this important work. Links to this paper, as well as several others that we'll reference throughout the podcast, can be found in the show notes. As always, please remember that all content from the Journal of Athletic Training is open access to all readers, meaning that it's free of charge, thanks to funding from the National Athletic Trainers Association. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the JAT podcast feed on your preferred podcast app, Spotify, or YouTube. You can find out about more upcoming events or new episodes of our podcasts on our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts at JAT_NATA. Thank you for listening, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Dr. McGuine, thanks for joining us today. Would you mind providing a little bit of background information about yourself and just introduce yourself to the listeners?
As you mentioned, my name is Tim McGuine. I'm an athletic trainer and a researcher. My official title is called Distinguished Scientist here at the University of Wisconsin, School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm actually in the medical school. For my background, I've worked in multiple settings over the last 30-plus years as a certified athletic trainer. I worked in Division I college athletics. I've worked as a physician extender. I've worked as an outreach athletic trainer, traveling to schools. I've worked as an everyday athletic trainer at a high school. And now I'm fortunate enough to actually be in a researcher supervisory role where I'm involved in a number of projects from measuring the outcomes associated with different orthopedic conditions to my research focus is really to look at, I'm interested in looking at methods to prevent, treat, identify, and our injuries in adolescent athletes, and ultimately look at the outcomes associated with those injuries in that population.
Yeah, based on the table of contents at the Journal of Athletic Training over the last year or two, it seems like you've had some success in those areas and are really moving the ball forward on making sure that athletic trainers have the knowledge they need to improve care. So it's been impressive to see how much you've been able to get done in that area.
We've been lucky, but as I like to say, is unlike many athletic trainer researchers where they do a lot of the work in the lab, my lab consists of, you know, athletic fields, gymnasiums, courts, and competition venues across the state of Wisconsin. So while my name is on there for getting this data together, it's really the athletic trainers out in the school settings are really the integral component to what we're doing here and getting the data put together for our publications.
Yeah, it's amazing how many, I'm a researcher as well, and how much it just takes taking the first step out of the lab to realize that it's not as scary as it sounds like it's going to be. If you just kind of commit to it, you can get some pretty impressive stuff done. Athletic trainers usually want to help, and the buy-in is pretty high in the profession for wanting to further what we know about clinical care.
And I'm surprised with that. When I first started getting outside the lab and doing that, it was hard to convince some people to get on board. But now, it's less hard interesting to know that I've had athletic trainers come to me and thank me for being able to be part of our research. They said they learn more, they take away knowledge, and instead of just collecting data for us, they feel better prepared as high school athletic trainers by participating in our research. So it's kind of a win-win for both of us.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's when we talk about interprofessional education and interprofessional care, we usually think about multiple different medical professionals working together. But it's also interesting to see when you have athletic trainers who have different roles or different goals in their job working together, how much you can learn from each other and how much you can take home from what's going on in the clinic versus what's going on in the lab.
Yes, exactly. I think the two, I think some people think there's lab research and there's field research, but I said I think there's really a synergy. We need to have both, mm-hmm. and both feed off each other and help drive the next questions in each setting. I think it's very important to do so.
So the main reason I wanted to interview you today is that in the last month, there's been a publication that you were the first author on that is now online first and available at the Journal of Athletic Training's website. And it's titled The Influence of Athletic Trainers on the Incidence and Management of Concussions in High School Athletes. I was wondering if you would be able to provide the readers with just a brief synopsis of the purpose of the paper and what some of the primary findings were.
Well, the overarching purpose of the paper is to show, I guess, how athletic trainers as licensed providers in school settings actually can impact specific conditions or injuries that take place. My whole philosophy, my overarching philosophy for some of these things is I think we need to get away from thinking of sports injuries at the college or high school or youth setting as one-off or a sport issue. My philosophy has been for years that these injuries are really a public health issue. And so many times what we're dealing with in many of these settings is a public or a medical access issue. And so what we tried to do was, we said, knowing the fact that over the years I've seen firsthand how schools with high levels of athletic trainer care, to me, their athletes were doing better and had fewer comorbidities and better outcomes and fewer, you know, repeat injuries than athletes at schools with lower levels of athletic trainer availability. I saw with my own self, my own eyes, with my own kids, all three were 12 season athletes at their high schools, participated in everything they could, and I felt relieved to know that they had an athletic trainer on site every day, that they got the best medical care possible. But I also realized that that wasn't the case all over, and that it was foolish of me to think of that as a, you know, this is the model, because not everyone has access to it. So I said, well, knowing that in mind, let's pick a condition, let's pick an injury and study that and show how that specific injury is impacted by various levels of athletic trainer care. In Wisconsin, we're very fortunate to have a lot of athletic trainers out there, probably 95% plus of the high school athletes have access to an athletic trainer, but it varies to a great extent. It can be an hour a week at a high school versus 45 to 50 hours a week. We have schools where they have 2.5 full-time equivalent FTE athletic trainers in the fall. And 20 minutes away, we have a school that goes to a high school, an athletic trainer goes to a high school for an hour.
Wow.
And I said, so while the schools pat themselves on the back for having access to athletic trainers, and they do, the availability and the services they can provide are dramatically different. And so that's what I tried to go ahead and see. Can we determine that? Can we quantify that instead of just, here's what I think is going on. Let's study it. Let's document what's happening.
So before we get to the kind of primary findings of the study, can you just talk us through a little bit about the collaborative process with athletic trainers in the community and how the data collection process evolved? What was your involvement? What were the local athletic trainers responsible for? And how did you find the collaboration to work?
Yeah, so when we do these studies, we put a call out initially through our Wisconsin Athletic Trainers Association, and I reach out to people that have done work with us in the past. We usually have a specific question in mind. We have an IRB-approved protocol, and then we reach out to the school's athletic trainers and say, this is what we want to study. Would you be interested in helping us out? Now, there's a couple of parameters that we have to do. They all have to become members of our research team. So they have to complete their online research training curriculum core through the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. They have to do their HIPAA certifications, et cetera. And we add them to the protocol. So we have them do this training, we add them to the protocol, and then we provide materials to them out at the schools. It may be having sessions like this where we Skype and go through the process. We may actually go out to different school groups and athletic trainers and say, this is the research plan. Here's how we're going to consent and enroll these subjects. Mm-hmm. And so a typical thing is we get the materials out. We get them out to their preseason player parent meetings where they introduce the study. They distribute the study information forms, subject consent forms, any baseline demographic forms, and collect those at that time. So they enroll those subjects. Once they're enrolled, we get that information back. We put them in an online database such as REDCap and that they have access to. And then these athletic trainers are basically following the athletes every day of every practice and every game to determine what's happening on that site. You know, did they practice? Did they not? If they played, was it a competition away? Was it at home? Did they get hurt? If they were hurt, what was the injury? What was the mechanism? Mm-hmm. And reporting all those other things that go in. And then at the end of the data collection, and in addition to that, then we look at the end of the data collection, we try to look at the links between baseline demographics and prospective, you know, injury exposures, or excuse me, practice and competition exposures and injuries, and do the analysis it that way. We're very fortunate to have a good group. We pay the athletic trainers. So an athletic trainer, for example, in this study, if they would have collected data for us for a year, would have got $1,000 to go ahead and do this. And that's it's integral to that, that the NATA was, you know, funding this. And I said, you know, a lot of the money you're going to give me is passed through directly to the athletic trainers collecting the data. I don't want to keep the money. They need the money because they're doing the data collection for us. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Where can I sign up? That sounds great.
We also now can give category B CEUs because category B CEUs said if they're a member of the research team, they can get CEUs for this. And the University of Wisconsin requires every athletic trainer to be a member of our research team. Mm-hmm. So so we tell people in this study, they would get a laptop or excuse me, a tablet computer, like an iPod or excuse me, an iPad, $1,000 and 10 CEUs to go ahead and collect the data for us.
I mean, that's the key, right? It's not always about financial compensation, but if the clinician or the parent or the patient can feel like they're also getting some new knowledge or improved care from their involvement, it's a win-win. Everyone seems to want to be involved at that point. So that's a great system. I was wondering, you don't have to relitigate the entire results and discussion section of the paper, but are there some key takeaways from this paper specifically for athletic trainers that you think that they should know?
Well, real simple that, you know, if you have lower level of athletic trainer ability, and I don't want to say I'm criticizing the quality of the athletic trainer ability. I'm talking just how many hours you're there. Mm-hmm. If you have a low, we model our schools into three categories, low availability, moderate, or high. And we found that the reported concussion rates in the low athletic trainer availability schools were less than half of what we would expect on previously published research. So where we would expect, you know, overall high school population, about 5% of the kids, depending on the sport, have a rate of concussion, have sustained a concussion. In the low athletic trainer availability schools, it was much lower, as around 2%. So we thought, we think we're underreporting at that. Just as important is that then once the concussions occurred and they were evaluated and they said, yes, this meets the criteria for concussion, that we looked at the post-concussion management activities because we know there's consensus-based guidelines that we want to have a follow-up with physicians, possible academic modifications, get in touch with the coaches. We want to do things like have a return-to-play protocol. We want to monitor symptoms and see when they resolve. We want to do follow-up testing, whether it's the BEST, the SCAT, 3, whatever, to go ahead and do this and monitor how the athlete is recovering. And once their symptoms have resolved, we want to have a return-to-play protocol. We don't just want to throw them out. So then we looked at those elements of our consensus-based and said, how are those followed? And no surprise, in these schools with the moderate or high levels of athletic trainer ability, you had a greater ability to, A, contact the parents, do academic modifications, have a return-to-play protocol, do multiple post-concussion interventions, and ultimately they kept the athletes out longer mm-hmm. than the schools in the low availability. So we thought they're treating and managing it more appropriately in those high athletic trainer availability settings.
Yeah, a lot of these findings make a lot of sense when you sit down and think about them. I mean, you can only provide high quality care when you're actually there to provide the care. And so if availability is a struggle, it only makes sense that student athletes may not be receiving the care that they need.
Exactly. And as I want to keep pointing out, we're not criticizing the ability of the athletic, the training, mm-hmm. or the skills of the athletic trainer. We're just saying, you know, what can you do given your status? For example, I had to fill in at a high school last fall and for a situation where the athletic trainer couldn't be there and we were contracted to do so. I said, I'll go out. And ostensibly, I was going to cover a JV and varsity soccer, boys soccer game. And I got there, and the athletic director said, just so you know, we have a tennis quadrangular going on, a dual swim meet going on, a varsity JV, and freshman volleyball going on. Football is practicing a mile that way, youth football starting here over on this field in an hour, and you're it.
Yeah, there was also a rodeo going on downtown.
Right. And so as much as I look, I said, so I literally counted up. I mean, there were probably 400-plus athletes there in those couple of hours that would possibly need medical care, and I was the only person to do it. There's just no way to offer adequate care in that situation. Maybe emergency medical care, minimal emergency medical care, but there's no ability to do anything else. And again, so many athletic directors are interested. They want the athletic trainer at the event, okay, but then there's no rehab going on. Mm-hmm. There's no long-term follow-up going on. If you're out at a competition site, you can't deal with a cross-country runner who has anterior knee pain if I'm on the soccer field, you know? So that's sort of the thing we got to think about.
Yeah, it does seem like there's been a jump in the willingness of administrators to contract or to have access to athletic training services. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems like the next, you know, critical step is going to be for it to be adequate athletic training services and adequate coverage. You know, it's everything works incrementally in our profession, it seems. But what can athletic trainers do from your perspective, you know, at the high school level or middle school level to advocate directly to administrators? Not only that it's important that there are some times where access is available, but that access is sufficient to actually meet the needs of the athletes in those environments.
Well, I think using data like we're showing that we're going to miss things. Again, this is just one thing. This is concussion, but what about the ankle sprains, the shoulder dislocations, the maybe the person dealing with heat illness injury? There's so many other things we could do. So I think we have to get in front of the decision makers and say, again, it's great you have athletic trainers, but do we have them at the level? And we have to point out that, and maybe even use some of the other NATA data at the collegiate setting was, you know, collegiate staffing was much less until they started studying it and showing what needed to be done adequately. Mm-hmm. And once they did that, institutions all over started saying, hey, it's not just having the athletic trainers, having them in sufficient number with training to go ahead and do what they're doing. That's what we're hoping is done with this. It's interesting. One of our co-authors just said he was being interviewed out of California about their state licensure efforts, and their state just wants to use this for licensure. Mm-hmm. I was contacted by a group in Oklahoma that's trying to get athletic trainers in underserved areas, and they asked about the data and how they could use that and use this to put to the funders and the legislators to say, this is examples of the research that's showing we have a deficit that we need to address.
Yeah, I think you bring up an interesting point there, something that I try to tell athletic trainers every time I go and speak in a clinical setting or in a regional or state meeting is we love when you contact us. You know, we'd love to be able to help you with your local or state issue. Our data is to help improve care and improve access. And I'm sure, I'm guessing from the conversations that I've had with you in the past, you feel the same way, especially when you've got data like this that you know could actually help tomorrow with an advocacy case.
That's what I'm hoping for. And I'm hoping we use it in the right way. I said, you know, I talked to some people, I said, well, this just shows how schools that don't offer adequate care should drop all their sports. I said, that's exactly the wrong thing I think we need to do. We need to really work with and find the solutions. As somebody said, you know, it's interesting, the model in Wisconsin is such that, you know, very few, if any, of the schools actually pay for all of the cost of the athletic trainer. Most of them have it subsidized to 50 to 100% by a medical provider. Mm-hmm. So a local medical provider may go ahead and do that. And that's a double-edged sword. It's great that we do that. But then also to the local medical providers, if you want credit for doing this, you need to fund it adequately as well. I saw one school in our service area who was under third athletic trainer in, I think, less than 2 years. And when I asked about the turnover, it became very apparent that the medical provider wanted to pay the athletic trainer $12,800 a year. So I said, no offense, they had a lot of turnover with that. Well, obviously. So one of the things I'm always cognizant of when I go to the schools and I get out and I see what the great job they're doing, some of these athletic trainers are just doing fantastic work, just fantastic work at the schools. I always ask them, well, hey, how's your employment setting? Did your employer treat you well? Mm-hmm. You know, with the reorganizations and merging in medical cares, are they recognizing your value? Are you getting comp time? Do they do that? And some cases, that's the case. They're doing a good job. Other cases, it's like, this is why we're going to have turnover. We have our most vulnerable population in terms of high school athletes. and that we're not putting the resources there to go ahead and treat them. And I think it's very important. The other thing is to not always point fingers at the schools, because in Wisconsin, we're finding out also, while the legislative efforts and our state athletic association is very proactive in terms of here's what needs to be done, and here's what happens with a concussion. You can't go back on your high school football field. If you've been suspected of having a concussion, you have to be evaluated by a licensed medical provider, whether you're on a soccer field, basketball court, anything, you have to do that. But we have a club system in Wisconsin where none of those rules apply. So while the legislator will say, hey, high school athletes need to have this level of care, they don't have any of those same mandates for the club athletes, which is interesting because with their specialization data, we know that 60% of our basketball, soccer, volleyball players participate in as many or more competitions outside the high school setting than do in the high school setting. So we said from a public health perspective there too, it's like, why do we have this great standards? As one athletic director told me, he said, when I have a soccer event here, I have to have an athletic trainer. I have to have an emergency action plan. I have to have an AED. I have to do all these things. But the club soccer can come in and use these same fields on Saturday with none of those requirements.
Yeah, which is really interesting because based on the recent kind of popular press attention that the monetization of youth sport, especially in the club environment, has undergone in the last few years, it would seem that the resources should be available to provide medical coverage, especially in large clubs. But that doesn't seem to be a focus or an interest, maybe because it's a more for-profit model instead of it being a not-for-profit.
It could be. And some people said, well, where's the organization? You know, you can... In Wisconsin, you can go, and probably at Michigan State, you can too, right? You can, in the state of Michigan, you can go to a Michigan High School Athletic Association and see their board of directors, see bylaws, see everything. Try to find that with the club entities.
I noticed that you're also a co-author on another publication that's online first at the Journal of Athletic Training website regarding socioeconomic status in the community and school and how that influences access to athletic trainers in Wisconsin. I was wondering, given the information you've already shared with the listeners about your concussion findings, how that kind of interacts with what you found about socioeconomic status and maybe what your kind of next step in investigating resources versus access in the high school environment might be.
Well, yeah. So the paper you're mentioning is something we did. It actually is a prelude to this one to determine what school availability was set up in Wisconsin, what it was like. We went ahead and did this dramatic survey of we went to every school athletic director and every outreach athletic trainer, said what schools you go to, how often you're there, what do you do. And we had that data sitting there, and I could see just eyeballing in the data set the schools in the counties with I would consider more rural or urban had much lower access to number of hours of athletic trainers. And so then we got data from their State Department of Public Instruction regarding measures of poverty, such as free and reduced lunch in public schools. And then we also looked at U.S. Census data on median household incomes by county. And there's a direct relationship that the schools in the counties with the highest levels of poverty, the lowest median household income, had far fewer hours of access of athletic trainers. And we looked in the individual public schools. If a school had a high level of poverty, kids basically eligible for free and reduced lunch, they had far fewer hours. So that tied into the whole thing. It's not that the schools don't want to do this. They may be hamstrung by other resources. The fact that they have more poor kids, their income isn't there. They don't have three or four medical providers tripping over themselves to provide athletic trainers at those settings. There may be one rural hospital system that with the current, reimbursement climate is losing money with Medicare, Medicaid reimbursements and those things. And now they say, we can't provide this. So it's all tied together. It's not one or the other. Long-term, I said it'd be great. We have two schools of thought. I'd love to, the whole policy thing. How do we increase that? How do we bridge that gap in the schools that need the most underserved areas that need more access to athletic trainers, where it's inner city, Milwaukee or Detroit or Cleveland, to get them there and the rural access as well. The other thing it's I'd really like to look at, this is essentially, even though it was conducted over a year or two, this is more of a cross-sectional study. I would love to look at long-term health outcomes from kids before they get to high school till afterwards based on athletic trainer availability. I'd like that cohort. If the skies would open up and millions of dollars would rain down on me, absolutely, I'd enroll 10,000 kids around the country in a study with different socioeconomic stratas and different settings in grade four, and then follow them for the next 10 years of their life, 20 years of their life, to find out what happened to those kids. Because I'm convinced that if they go to a school with high levels of athletic trainer availability, they're going to have better health outcomes after high school and be more active, physically active as adults, which is ultimately what we want. You know, as a healthy society, we want that. I'm convinced we can't sell it as a sport issue. It's got to be a public health issue. Mm-hmm. It's got to be. You know, I could tell, I sometimes dismayed by the athletic training groups. I talked to the students. I said, if we're all excited about getting, you know, that star basketball player back to shoot free throws in the regional championship game, great. But that's not going to get the interest of the big people in terms of how we're going to fund initiatives to get athletic trainers everywhere. We need to show how the health of all these people are impacted by athletic trainers. And I'm convinced they are. I'm really convinced they are. It's not a sport issue. It's a public health issue. And athletic trainers are integral. As I said, in many of these settings in Wisconsin, the licensed athletic trainer will be the only licensed medical provider these kids will have contact with on a daily or weekly basis. It's not their physician. It's not a physical therapist. It's not a school nurse. It's nobody. It's the athletic trainer. And let's leverage that and say we're there, we're important, we're credentialed. Let's use that to increase public health.
Well, I think that's a great point to end on. I think that's a lot of what we're hoping to see more and more resources and research available for clinicians is just to help them to have some data to confirm that that's the case and to be able to get them to advocate. So Dr. McGuine, I'd like to thank you for being on JAT Chat this month. And we look forward to seeing some of your work coming off of this project. I'm sure there's going to be additional publications that come out on other injuries or populations. So we're really looking forward to it.
Thanks for giving us the opportunity.